Well, having nearly wrecked my movie credibility in Bible class with my poor knowledge of Infinity War, I'm going to go ahead and just erase it completely right now. A movie came out last year called Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. I haven't seen it. I don't know a thing about it other than apparently it involves fighting and the unfortunate use of green plaid. Other than that, I don't have any idea what this movie is about, but the title has always intrigued me. That's just an interesting title. It's sort of an overwhelming title, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. I mean, I find it difficult to keep up with one thing in one place for 5 minutes. I mean, this is just beyond me, but the title's interesting to me. And as a Christian, what the title puts me in mind of, particularly as I was working on the sermon this week, is that the only one that we could really talk about who knows everything, who is everywhere, all at once, is God. And I don't know, the movie has anything to do with God at all, but this is what I think of when I think about this sort of all-knowing, all-present, all-at-once being that can only be God. Because what we know about God, because what the Bible tells us about God, is that God is omnipresent. That means that God is what? That He is everywhere, at the same time, all the time. If you're a mother, you probably sometimes try to be in two places at once, don't you? You try to be in two places at once, but you can't. You can't even manage two places at once. Where is God? God, according to Scripture, is everywhere, all the time, at the same time. And that's what omnipresent means. Not only that, but He is also, the Bible tells us, that God is omniscient. Omniscient means that God knows what? God knows everything there is to know. Imagine that. God knows everything. There's nothing that you could know. There's nothing you can't know that God doesn't know. God is completely, perfectly present and completely, perfectly knowledgeable. And the classic passage on that is going to be our text for this morning, Psalm 139. And so if you'd like to turn to Psalm 139, we'll spend most of our time there. We have been studying the attributes of God, just a few of them. As you can imagine, an infinite being like God has a lot of attributes, and we can't get to all of them. So we're just talking about a few, and we're going to wrap that up this morning. So far, we have thought about two of the attributes of God. We have thought about the eternity of God, which means that what? That God has always existed, and that God will always continue to exist. God is eternal. Now that you're here, now that you exist at your conception in your mother, now that you're here, you will always exist from now on. You will always be somewhere. But you were not always here. The angels were here before you, but they weren't always here. The earth was here before you. It was not always here. There's only one being in the entire universe or beyond who has always been existent, and that is God. He is eternal. The other attribute that we talked about, this was last week, is God's incomprehensibility. A nice, appropriately long word for this attribute of God. And that is that you will not understand everything about God or what He does. And the person who learned that we saw last week was Job, if you'll recall. Job, who stood up to God and put his chest out and his head back and said, "I don't like what's going on here, God, and I want you to show up and explain it to me. I'll be waiting." And God did show up. And what did God say? God said, well, I could explain it to you, but you wouldn't get it. You don't even know how the sun comes up. You don't even know how animals give birth. You don't even know anything about the stars. You don't even know how the heavens function. You don't know any of the, if you can't understand something about the physical world, you can't possibly get what's going on in the spiritual world. And so I could tell you, but you wouldn't get it. Now, the reason that we're doing this is not only because we need to know God, but because the attributes of God mean something to us. Because God is eternal, what that means is that we can trust Him. Because God is eternal, we can trust Him. The psalmist said in Psalm 90, you have been our refuge in all generations. You believe in the same God that Paul believed in, that David believed in, that Moses believed in, that Abraham believed in, that Adam first met in. It's the same God. He hasn't changed at all. And so you can trust Him because He's going to be here and He's going to be the same. In fact, you have to trust Him. You're just going to have to trust Him. Because a lot of things are going to happen in your life that you're not going to understand. And God could show up and explain it, and you still wouldn't get it. So at the end of the day, you're going to have to just say, I trust you to handle it. Today, we're talking, as I mentioned, about the omnipresence and the omniscience of God. And what we're going to see here is that we should trust God. A lot of times when we talk about the omniscience of God, the all-seeing eye, how's that make you feel? You know that song? I'm glad we don't. Is that even in our book? I'm glad we don't sing that. That's just creepy. There's an all-seeing eye watching you. It's a wonder that as kids we could even go to sleep at night after singing that song. It's creepy. And it's sort of a threat, really. I mean, I think the purpose of the song is sort of, if I remember, maybe not, but it's sort of a threat. You know, sort of like Santa Claus. He's watching. He sees everything. You better not pout. You better not cry. I'm telling you why, because God and Santa are watching. And if you mess up, they're going to see it, and they're going to get you. It seems like that's sort of the point of that. And so sometimes we look at the omniscience of God. He knows everything about me as a threat. The omnipresence of God, wherever you go, there God is, as a threat. We'll talk about some balance here. But that's not how David takes it in Psalm 139. That's not what David is doing with it. In Psalm 139, and that's what we're going to talk about. So here's what David says. Psalm 139 and verses 1 through 4, God knows everything. God knows everything about you. Everything. You think your mom knows everything about you? You think your mom has eyes in the back of her head? She does, by the way. I know she does. It was proven when I was a child. Things that she would know, and I'm like, how in the world did she know that? Tracy did it to our children. It was a beautiful thing to watch. So you think your mom knows everything? God knows everything about you. God knows what you're doing all the time. So let's just think about this as we go through it. God knows everything that you're doing all the time. Whatever you're doing this morning, last night, Saturday night, that could be dicey. Yesterday, Friday night, last week. You're by yourself, you're with other people. Whatever that was you were doing, God knows it. Whatever that was you were thinking, maybe you're pretty good about holding it together with what you do, but is this a little frightening? God knows what you're thinking. Oh, but I didn't say it. But God knows it. I didn't do it. God knows it. God knows what you are thinking all the time. Part of that is because God is everywhere. Psalm 139 and verses 5 through 10. Verse 7, where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? So the way that we typically read this is that David wants to. We're going to see that that's not what's going on here. But the way that we typically take this is David is like Jonah, and David's trying to get away from God. And he says, where could I go? I could go to heaven. Well, duh, you're there. I could go the other direction, go to Sheol, go down as far as I can. You're there. Take the wings of the dawn, dwell in the remotest part of the sea. There you are. Every time I show up, God says, there you are. You're already there. God is everywhere, all the time. And not only that, but verses 11 to 16, God sees everything. God sees everything. Even what you think or I think is unseeable. Even what you or I might think is unseeable. And so here's the way that David, he illustrates it a couple of ways. He says a couple of things about it. Look at verse 11. He says, if I say the darkness will overwhelm me and the light around me will be night, it's dark. There's no light. What does he say about that in verse 12? Even what? Even the darkness, it's not dark to you. It's like noon. When it's as dark as it can possibly be to God, it's like noonday. Darkness and light are alike to you. And David says, so he uses this example. We know that because David says, when I was in my mother's womb, which obviously is about as dark a place as there can be, no light there, it's total darkness. What does he say? God saw him. What was God doing? God was making and creating and weaving and forming him. Think about that. In this place in the womb of complete darkness, God is weaving a baby. Do surgeons do that? Do surgeons go, okay, we're going into surgery. We need to perform this really delicate surgery. Make it as dark as possible. What do surgeons want? When surgeons are doing intricate work, or woodworkers, or computer guys, or technical guys, whatever, whoever that is that's working on something, do they say, okay, turn the lights out so I can work? No, we want as much light as possible. But in the womb, when a baby is being put together in the womb, God is in there working, but it's what? It's completely dark. Think about that. Now, this is something hard for us to understand. When Tracy and I were having children, this is what we got to see. This was our picture. So they would show you this on the screen, and then they'd give you a little printout and go, here's your baby. And I'm like, it's like a kidney bean. I don't even know what that is. And you know how, you remember how they would do that, older parents? You remember how they'd point stuff out? Here's the head, here's the foot, here's the heart, it just looks like jelly to me. It looks like nothing to me. Isn't it amazing that now we can look into the womb and get 3D pictures of babies in the womb, a 3D picture, and then they can take that 3D picture and they can render it lifelike so that you see exactly what your baby looks like. Isn't that amazing? That's really new technology. You know what's even newer? I didn't even know they did this. I should have suspected it. I thought about you. You know what else you can do? You can get a view of your baby, get a 3D view of your baby, and guess what you can have somebody do? Print it out for you. I see big money in your future, Kent. Big money for this kind of thing. You can print your baby and hold him and literally see what is in the womb of the mother. Hold what's in the womb of the mother. In David's day, what could they see? Nothing. As far as they were concerned, the womb is a place of complete and total darkness. But who's in there? God. What is he doing? He's doing this amazing constructive surgery of putting a baby together in total darkness. How's he able to do that? Because to God, darkness is like what? It's light. It's all the same. Because God can see even the unseeable. God can see in the dark. But David also says, look at verse 16, that God can see the future. He says in verse 16, your eyes have seen my unformed substance. Notice this. In your book were written all the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them. Before you came out of the womb, what did God know about your future? Now, you can't see it. Your parents can't see it. Nobody can see it. Before you came out of the womb, what did God know about your future? Everything. God knew everything about your future. He knew where you were going to be sitting right now and where your head was going to be at right now. He knew you were going to be thinking that. Bill, he knew. Patty, he knew. Kim, he knew. God knows all that. He already knows those things. Now, it's important, just as an aside, that we understand there's a difference between pre-knowing and predetermining. It does not say that God made all of those things happen. And people get hung up, I'm not really sure why, people get hung up on this, but it's just not, pre-knowing is not predetermining. Those are two different, God knows everything about you. But you make the choices that you make and do the things that you do. He knew it, but you do it. Oh, that's good. I need to write that down. So it's not the same thing. But God sees everything, even the unseeable. So here's the question. What do we do with that? So I just want you to just take a moment, and I want you to just think about everything that we just said. God knows where you were yesterday. And everything that you were doing, and everything that you were thinking last week, last month, last year, today. God knows where you are, who you're with, what you're doing, what you're saying, and what you're thinking. Now, how does that make you feel? This is important. How does it make you feel? Don't tell me. But how does it make you feel to know that God saw that? God knew that. God heard that. God watched that. God was present when you were doing that, and he was watching that. How does it make you feel? This is important. What you thought and didn't say, what you wanted to do and did not do, all of those things. Just for comparison's sake, let's ask it this way. Let's say instead of God, let's say it was your mother or your grandmother or your spouse or your child who saw all of that, knew all of that, heard all of that, who knew all of those things. How does that make you feel? What's the comparison between mom knows it and God knows it? How does that make you feel? There are three basic feelings, I think, that we can have when it comes to this truth that God knows and sees everything. I think there's three basic feelings that we can have. One of them is not to feel anything at all. I think to a lot of people, all this is so abstract, it's just irrelevant. It's God knows everything. What impact does that have? I think to a lot of people, not much. I think to a lot of people, guilt, worry, dread, fear. But to a lot of people, believe it or not, I think, and this is where David is coming from. For David, it meant a couple of things. Number one, it meant worship. For David, it meant worship. Tom and I were talking between church and class a while ago about God and the magnitude of God, the knowledge of God, the presence of God. You know, we can walk outside and I could pick a piece of grass from the yard and I could study that thing for the rest of my life and I would never understand everything, even about that little tiny piece of grass. How much does God know about it? And it's not only that, but it's that entire yard out there. And it's not only that, but it's this whole area. And it's not only that, it's the planet. But it's not only that, it's the solar system. Not only that, it's the galaxy. And not only that, all the galaxies. And not only that, everything. God knows all of that all the time right now. Doesn't that produce in you some sort of awe? Some sort of amazement? Some sort of worship? That's what it did for David. David said in verse 6, "Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain it." It's just too much. And yet for God, it's just another day at the office. It gives thanks in verse 14. In verse 17, he says, "How precious are your thoughts to me, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. When I awake, I am still with you." Do you see how it produces in David? Thinking about the knowledge of God, how it produces worship. Let me ask you a question. Who is that guy? Who is that guy right there? There's nobody in the room who doesn't know who that guy is. We all know who that guy is. Who's that guy? You know who that is. There's nobody in here that doesn't know who these people are. Einstein? Bill Gates? Why do you know these people? Why do you know these people? Why have these people become synonymous with intelligence? If you don't know the answer to something, you'll say, "Wow, I don't know. I'm no Einstein." You know, if you're having trouble figuring something out on your computer, well, I mean, it's not like I'm Bill Gates. Why do you know these people? Because they're so intelligent. They're so brilliant. They know so much. And so they're famous and they're praised. And they're everybody knows who they are and everybody acknowledges them. And they're exalted in our world because they know so much. Do they know everything? Does Einstein know everything? Did he? Did he know most things? What Einstein knew in reality, what Bill Gates knows, is the tiniest fraction of what can be known about the universe. And yet these men are heroes. Almost worshipped in our society by many. God knows everything. But here's the other thing. For David, and this is the latter part of the psalm, for David, this is good news. This is good news. I want you to notice verse 10. If all we had was the end of verse 10, it would be a little frightening. Look at the end of verse 10. David says, "No matter where I go, your right hand will lay hold of me." That sounds a little threatening. Right? If I say to one of my kids, "Boy, I'm going to get a hold of you," that's not good. It's never good. That never means we're going for ice cream. It never does. "I'm going to get a hold of you" means you've had it. "Your right hand will lay hold of me." Sounds like a threat, but not when you look at the first part of the verse. He says, "Even there your hand will lead me." You see, David is not threatened by God's presence. David is not scared. He's not worried. He's not in dread. He doesn't fear because of God's presence. He is comforted because it means three things. The fact that God is perfectly present with you shows that God values you. The fact that God is perfectly present with you and knows you as well as he does means that he values you. Notice what he says in verse 5, for instance. Notice what he says in verse 5. David says to God, "You have enclosed me." Notice this, you're all around me. He says, "You've enclosed me behind," you're back there. "You've enclosed me before," you're up there. So you're back there. You're up there. What else does he say? "You have laid your hand upon me." Where is God in David's life? He's behind. He's in front. And he's above. What has he done? What has God done for David? He's completely covered him with his presence. Think about it this way. When you want to go to Walmart, you just jump in your car and go to Walmart, right? You just jump in, it's just you, one car, you're at Walmart. The president wants to jump in his car and go somewhere. Does the president just jump in a car and drive off? When the president is driving from one place to another, what is he driving? And he's not driving at all, but where do they do? They've got a motorcade, right? When the president goes somewhere, he's got this vast, elaborate motorcade. And it's always set up in exactly the same way. The black squares and ovals that you see there are cars and motorcycles in a presidential motorcade. This is whenever the president's going to be driven somewhere, this is what it takes to get him there. So we at the front, we've got what are called sweepers. Usually the motorcycles, cops on motorcycles that are called sweepers. What are they out there for? They're out there to see if there's anybody out there in front who's going to cause a problem, and if they are, they're going to sweep them out of the way. So the president's got somebody going in front of him, and behind him he's got what's called the rear guard. Why are they back there? You don't want anybody creeping up behind and getting the president back there. And so you've got a rear guard, and then over the whole thing you've got, in Overwatch, you've got a helicopter. Where's the president in all of that, do you reckon? Where's the president? He's right there. The president's right there. He's in the middle of all of that. Now, how come when the president wants to go somewhere, he gets sweepers, not to mention electronic counter-surveillance, biohazard teams, ambulance, and all kinds of other stuff? How come the president gets sweepers and a rear guard and a helicopter, and you just jump in and you're all by yourself? How come he gets that and you don't? Because he's more important than you are. He's more valuable than you are. And not to your family. I know they think you're kind of special. But as far as the big picture and the worldwide stage and the welfare of our country goes, he's a lot more important than you are. So he gets in front, in back, and above. Well, you do too. And it's from God. David says that God is in front of me. He is behind me, and he is over me. God values me. It means that God can help me. God is with me, and it means that God can help me. If he's not with me, he can't help me. David in this passage is talking about his enemies. And he says he's got lots of enemies around him. People who hate him and want to destroy him. But he doesn't worry about it. Why not? When I was in elementary school, I learned that a boy in my class wanted to beat me up. Now, I don't know why that was, and you can't imagine either. You know me. Why would anybody want to do me harm? I don't know. But he did. He got something against me, and I don't know what it was, but he wanted to beat me up, and he was going to get me between when I got off the bus and I got home. So I asked a friend of mine, will you get off the bus with me and walk with me to my home? And she said yes. I may be a lot of things, but I'm not proud when it comes to pain. She was a big girl. She was tall. She was strong. She was tough, and nobody messed with her. And so I said, when I get off the bus, will you walk with me? And she said, yes. And she did. And I never got beat up then. The problem was, she wasn't always with me. The problem was, there was just a small time there where she could be with me. Those other times I was unprotected. But God is with you when? God is with you all the time. All the time. His presence is perfect. And it also means, according to David, that God can help improve me. Notice what he says at the end here. I think this is really interesting. In Psalm 139 and verse 23, He says, "Search me, O God, and know my heart." Think about that. Now, when I was asking you a moment ago, knowing that God knows everything that you think, how does that make you feel? I want you to notice that David asked God to do it. David wants God to do it. David says to God, "Search me and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any hurtful way in me, and lead me in the everlasting way." It might be scary to us that God knows our thoughts. David said, "I'm glad." Because then God can root those out and he can help me get rid of them and be a better person. For David, it was a blessing. Well, next month, so next week, Lord willing, we'll be at Isaiah and I'll be at Bible camp. So we will not be here. I believe Ray is going to be preaching next Sunday morning. But when I get back, we will begin a new series of lessons called Pictures of Forgiveness and Salvation. The Bible is very, very rich with imagery about various things. And one of those things is our salvation. God so wants us to understand our salvation that he uses lots of sort of word pictures. And we're going to look at some of those word pictures and see what it teaches us about salvation. Tonight, we will be, Lord willing, in Newport at 6 o'clock. Is that right? 6? Is it 6? We will be in Newport tonight at 6, and we'll be talking about Ephesians 1 and 2 for our service with the Newport Church. So before then we're done, we're going to be singing our song in just a moment. We'll have that up on the PowerPoint. We've talked about the eternity of God. God's eternity gives us the assurance that we can trust him. We've talked about the incomprehensibility of God. That means we're going to have to trust him. And we've talked this morning about his perfect presence and his perfect knowledge. That should not be a source of fear to us. It should be a source of confidence and a source of comfort, but that is only if you trust him. And so the question this morning for us, each of us, is, do you trust him? Do you trust him? Have you put your life in his hands? Have you said to him, "I know I am a sinner. I know I am lost. I know I am condemned, and I want to be saved, and I trust you to do it"? Have you said to him, "I know I am weak and ignorant and foolish, and I cannot figure things out on my own, and if I'm going to get through this life without making it a complete disaster, I'm going to have to trust you and listen to you and do what you say"? Have you said that to him? Have you put your trust in him, in your salvation, in baptism, and do you continue to do it day by day? If you honestly say to yourself this morning, "I am not trusting him. I have not trusted him for my salvation. I do not trust him day by day. I'm trusting myself and doing what I think is right." This is a great time for you to address that. In fact, it may be the only time that you have to address it. And we want to help you to do that. If you are not trusting him, if you have not trusted him for your salvation in baptism, if you are not trusting him daily in your life, we would love to help you with that. We would love to sit down with you and study the scriptures and show you from the Bible what you need to do. Not our opinion, not our church rules, our beliefs, but what God has said. Then you can begin to trust him. We would love to help you to do that. If we can help you with that, we'd love to. We'd love to talk to you privately after church, or you can come forward and take a seat on the front as we stand and sing this song.